It's there because you can make one. I know it's heresy, a sales tax, but until Oregon gets to that, we're going to continue to suffer. In the long run, the project I'm involved in churches, business, and growing, and I invite everyone to be involved with, is the Quality Public Service Project. We're contributing money, all of us, and we will begin with props and public speaker training to teach Oregonians what is the general fund, where does the money come from, where does it go, and what's causing the problems based on what legislative revenue staff and professionals teach us. Not it is to be totally nonpartisan and to not pick out business to pick on. This is to be come from the grassroots citizens, which we have begun the process, but we need time. We need time, and we're going to have to educate thousands of citizens. So what do we do to bridge? I've just mentioned a few thoughts I have in any way we can to help you, because it's certainly not your fault that all this has happened. Part of this, I want to say, not in a negative way, has to lay at the voters themselves. I personally feel inside me that they should vote, because they let us here, and I continue to hear everybody blame all this on the recession. Little did we tell the public that we were falling further and further behind. I only have one comment because Steve raised it. But the little girl that was just murdered is my daughter's. Her children, sisters are, I've been caring for. And in Oregon City, we have a belief. And by the way, we're not mad at the police. But when state children's services can't get these abuse of kids files out to police on time, and I happen to serve here and know that these budgets are not adequate because of the ballot measures preceding the recession, then I have very damn strong feelings. Because I love the kids, and they're not the only ones that are going to be harmed. What's really happening to the Ashleys of the world, someone mentioned, it will increase. We have been falling further and further behind because of Measure 5. And Oregon's got to step to the plate, not the legislature. They have to be taught the simplistic values of what this system is and how it's broken, because it's past broken. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Ralph. Hold on. I'll give you some ammo. The real number is $4.3 billion, total all the measures together. Okay. And I say this to Steve in the room, I'm not talking the policy. You know, 5, 11, health plan, 4750, inmate work, is $4.3 billion. Say that a different way to underscore what Ralph's saying, is that in the greatest economy in the history of the planet, our general fund grew from approximately $5 billion to $10 billion, 100% increase. Of that increase, of that $5 billion increase, 4.3 was otherwise directed through the initiative process. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out when we hit the first little speed bump, and this is a cliff in the road, why we're having the difficulty we're having. But that's not a comment on the public policy of the policies implemented by the voters. That's a comment on the cost. I want to ask you one other question. What were those numbers you rattled off with regard to levels of state tax? I mean, number two in the country on...
We're second, according to the Revenue Committee testimony, not by me, to second in income tax.
Okay.
We're 35th now because of two property measures.
35th in prop tax.
That's correct.
Okay.
And we've now sunk to 47th in overall tax responsibility as it relates, I want this very clear, to income. That's U.S. Department of Commerce by the census this last time. We're sinking. We have three more shots to go. The reason I threw that out, I'm really, really sorry, I didn't know the girls were going to come up here. The reason I threw that out is that the other legislature that the New York Times wrote about in many states are having impacts on budget similar, and that's called the initiative process. I'm not against the initiative process. What I am for is a tremendous education program of our public of what they've done to cost us and dedicate funds and divert those funds. Quite frankly, if I had my way, the lottery would be going to K-12 totally. It's that simple. Totally. Because what other economic development is there? That if we have a weak education system, everybody talks about it, but if I were high tech and they're the one who kept us out of hot water, which according to testimony, for 10 years, then I look at education going down the flush, down the toilet in this state, I begin saying, you know, Joe, Sue, Mary, maybe we ought to be in another state. And if that happens and we continue to over-depend on the income tax, folks, give a combined with 47.50, we're in worse shape. But since we don't have a backup tax, I'm in a position to try to move economic development ahead. I've gone to the State Transportation Commission. I've gone wherever I can to preach it, and it wasn't my members who do the work. Those are private sector or the trades. It's because they pay income tax into this general fund to help all the groups behind me with their vulnerability.
Let the record show that Ralph Groner invited Mary Botkins to move to another state. That's what it is.
Thank you.
But hold on. Did you want to, Ralph?
Well, I want to make a comment, ask a question, see if you can see this figure also. The change that spelled Measure 5 was not only a huge growth in the state budget from $5 to $10 billion, which occurred because of a great economy and was solely for the income tax, which helps in a great economy. But the overall tax burden dropped from 25th to 27th during that time because of the shift of those taxes, primarily off commercial real estate and the cap on private real estate. And so the cost, the extra $5 billion, a huge amount of that went into K-12 to make up the loss of local property taxes. So you talk about a huge change in the budget of the state, it was there. At the same time, we're losing the other side of property taxes and picking it up for K-12. And now, with the economy going in the direction, if we're solely set income taxes, we finally are facing reality about what makes your fine. You can't get something for nothing in the end.
It almost
did for 10 years. And the legislature, and frankly, the Republican Party, has taken full hits for this thing. And frankly, I think they should have. This is not their fault, which I would make your fine.
I want to ask you, if you don't mind, thank you, but where I'm kind of a weirdo is, and labor gets mad at me on this, so I'm going to say it for them. We can't, any of us, any longer afford to say business pays too little, individual too much. I disagree. I have a specific proposal that angers business likes it, but mine is I'm over all that. That's got to stop. To me, what we need is a fair sales tax, and I got it figured. I won't get into it, but we reduce the income tax. Remember, small business is paying right now 9%. We're paying 9 at the flat level. Corporate, I believe, is, if I'm wrong on this,
Jones here,
6.6. I'd reduce income tax on everybody in this state to 6. Now I've got some money going to small business to help them. And now Ralph's got more money to spend on his granddaughter and buy that new computer. It's the income tax in this state that's become flat and the enemy. And then what I would do is have I call it a consumption tax. That's a euphemism, I know, for a sales tax, excluding food, drugs, low-income people wouldn't even pay on the first levels. And I would make sure we had a consumption tax for K-12 dedicated, not just decent, but really dedicated with a reserve fund. And I'd make sure we pick that up with a sales tax to reduce the income tax, one, that generates money into the economy, and two, it makes sure that Oregon has a stable fund for education. But that'll never pass. I don't know why I threw it out, but it works.
I'll say never. Representative Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ralph, you remember in 97, we had a transportation package that failed, and then one in 99 that failed, and then the smallest relatively tiny package in 01 that passed. 97, we tried to make the case of what the income tax impact would be of that package, and it was pretty significant in terms of those dollars being invested. The issue about the bridges is a very clear issue about economics and economic development, because the limitations are on bridges are actually making some areas of the state less economically viable than they already are. What's your impression, though, in terms of if we were able to make those kinds of investments? What are you hearing in terms of when you could actually get work being done, when you could actually see the economic impact of it, when you could actually see any reflection actually in the economy?
I asked, Mr. Chairman, Representative Devlin, yesterday I asked ODOT's lobbyist that question, naturally, not knowing I was going to speak here. Money's there, we're ready, quote. So, now that may have meant money's there, we're ready on highway construction, because the bridge issues may not be ready till January. I hope it's ready now. Primarily because I do believe the voters of this state, the Oregonian, did a wonderful three-part series on our unsafe bridges. I wasn't aware of that till I read those. And the fact is that I think we could begin moving on the bridges now, getting people to work. If not, they're not ready till January, and they all promised me Bruce is working on this and a wonderful job, and that we'll be ready. But I don't know that we can wait. I think we need to get the bonding going either for the bridges or for the highways. We're ready for the highways, and we're going to have to do that with a fee increase. We're the lowest in the nation, and we need to go up $15 to save our bridges and our highways. And if the public opposes that and we go to, I think it was 43rd, then we have a more serious disconnect than I ever would have dreamed. Not just economic development, Representative, but safety. Those bridges, some of them, are unsafe. We've gone from what Bob Russell's here from the truckers, but from 75,000 or 72,000 up to higher, and we didn't build commensurate bridges with the safety built into those, as you know that we should have. So we've got to get those fixed. They're not only an economic development issue, but a safety issue, and I think Oregonians would support us doing this and would have supported us doing this all along.
Thank you, Ralph. John, you're the official gatekeeper.
Jacqueline.
You jumped up and down. Any updates?
At 2522,
that the President's
State is now driving around
the back 35, there's 13
minutes left.
That's important information this committee needs. Jacqueline? Hey, don't be putting in this extraneous detail in here. We've got more information overload already. Ms. Zimmer, enter and sign in, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer Jones, and I'm the director of the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities. I also serve as the co-chair of the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this afternoon, and just to let you know a couple of things. I know that Mr. Nelson was up here a little earlier talking to you about the emergency board issues. I assume you're all up to speed on the fact that OPI, half of OPI would have been eliminated had we had e-board on Thursday. It's our hope that when you're looking at putting together funding to correct the shortfall that we have right now, that you will go back and pick up the $6.5 million that was assigned to the Department of Human Services as part of the third special session to spare those programs from reduction. So we don't look at this as a point-in-time issue. We think that the state has been running behind on human services for a very long time. So at the minimum, we'd love to see you go back and fix the third session issues for us. Just to let you know, and I feel kind of silly talking to you because I know I've talked to most of you individually, but we're assuming that somewhere around 30,000 seniors and people with disabilities will lose services as a result of the governor's proposed reduction.
How many?
30,000 to 31,000. If you add up all of the numbers in all of the reductions, and right now, SPD is a little busy, so, I mean, these are numbers that we've kind of cobbled together, but we have a significant number of people that are going to not just lose services, but not have any services to come back to. In the past, when we talked about cuts to, say, people in levels 15 through 17, we said they will they will quickly destabilize and come back in at a higher level. Well, we've eliminated all the way down to level 6, so there's really nowhere else for these people to come back in. We've completely cut holes in the safety net. There's just nowhere to put them. And I this reminds me of 1991 when we had a discussion about moving nursing home clients out into the curb. That's pretty much what we're looking at this time. Just to, you know, have you help us think through this, if you take people who are in level 10 that have 24-hour in-home care, that person's very dependent on someone else to help them get in and out of bed, use the toilet, bathe, shop, cook, et cetera, et cetera. But it's still less expensive as a general rule than having them in a nursing home. But if you take away 24-hour care, we don't know what we're supposed to do. We don't know what the alternative is. If they're a Medicaid client, nursing homes, those that are still open, aren't going to be all that excited about seeing them because they're not reimbursed for them at an adequate rate. We're actually just baffled completely by what we're supposed to do. We're terrorizing elderly people. We have a 90-year-old woman who's blind in one of our caseloads. She has outlived her 2 children. And we call upon families to provide a lot of the care, and yet if you've outlived your 2 children, you're 90-some-odd years old, and you're still ticking away in your own home, really, I mean, you can sort of wear everybody out around you by the time you're 90 that's been helping you for a long time. So we're just at a loss at what we're supposed to do here. And then, you know, it's really, it comes down to the economy. And I know I hear a lot of people say that you should run state government like a business. And I had a debate with my tire company the other day, and they gave me that line. And I said, tell me how many non-paying customers you're going to have today. Tell me how many people that you help today are going to generate no income to you whatsoever. And they said, well, none. Everyone's going to pay us for what we do. And I said, that's the difference. You're a business, but you don't have to take care of inmates or children or seniors. You don't have to take care of the mentally ill or people who have drug and alcohol. You're not taking care of anybody but yourself and your customers. That's the difference. The state's not a business when it comes to human services. You know, it's not the human service business. It's just human services. That's what we do. So I think that I'll still buy my tires there. I'm not sure. But if I've convinced him adequately, I'll go back. But we're part of the economic, you know, chain here in Oregon. We have 14,000 client-employed providers who provide in-home care to seniors and people with disabilities. 14,000. That's a lot of people. And they work for this state for slightly $1 an hour more than minimum wage with no benefits. We're just lucky that they do it. The average age of someone who provides in-home care is like 47. All right? We're getting rid of the spousal pay program under the governor's budget. That's 198 people whose spouses take care of them. We will eliminate that program completely, and then we will replace the spouse with a client-employed provider who no longer works for us because we've sort of essentially eliminated that program, and it, or a stranger who doesn't really know and it's not adequately trained. I kind of hate to go on about it because it just flat out doesn't make any sense. So, but just to keep in mind that those people are the kind of people that turn around and spend their money immediately in the community. They buy groceries, they buy gas, you know, they have kids as well. So you're eliminating, and I just wish I knew what the number was, but anytime that you lean entirely and solely on a family member to take care of another family member, that family member is not working out in the public. You know, we have a gentleman who takes care of his father who's had a stroke. He had his own business. He is no longer spending any time at all in his own business. In the last year, he didn't buy any equipment. He didn't buy any phones. He didn't buy any services. He didn't buy any cleaning supplies. He's not buying anything because he's spending all his time taking care of his father. So, you know, you can just see where economic development plays a role in human services and how important it is to the well-being of a community. And sort of finally, I think about, you know, if you see homeless people in your streets right now, and you see mentally ill people in your streets right now, and you see people when you walk downtown in Salem that you know need more help than they're getting, you can just imagine how many more of those people we're going to be seeing when drug and alcohol beds go away, when prescription assistance goes away, when the medically needy program goes away, when the OSIP program goes away, and how many of these programs you're going to find yourself in conflict with federal law. So we're just confounded by what it is we're supposed to do. OPI leaves October 1st. October 1st, that doesn't give us any time, nor will we really get the funding we need to case manage these people into other services. You're on OPI because that's it. You're on OPI because you've gone through and we've helped you put together this complex care plan, and then you get OPI, and then you pay a little for it. And, oh, by the way, all of these people in these levels, you know, 6 through 17 or 7 through 17, if they own a home and the state is helping through the Medicaid program, when they die, they lose a portion of their home. I mean, the state gets paid back eventually at some level for the care these people give or get. So, we'll take any suggestions you can give us. Ours is just that you adequately fund this and that you fund it for the future and that you, I know you're thinking about January, so are we. We prefer not to have this conversation again in January, but, you know, look at the funding that you're going to need to get you through then and take care of it now.
How, Jacqueline?
Well, I'm sure that you've heard a lot of suggestions that you share from a number of people, and
you're green and technical.
Well, we're, of course, you know, I guess that we sort of go to what we think might be the easiest places, and that's delaying certain ballot measures that have impacted the state's general fund, looking at tax credits that were given to see if they really are generating income to the state and whether or not we need to give any more tax credits.
Give me specifics.
Well, I wish I was as knowledgeable as people that sit here 24 hours a day are, but we clearly can't understand why always the answer to a beer increase in the beer and wine tax is no. If that had been on the books a number of sessions ago, it would have generated some income. We're not interested in harming Oregon's beer and wine industry. We think that's important, but we understand that you can't lead them out and tax sort of the rest of the nation. But a beer and wine tax, I think, is an easy one. And, you know, it would be nice if the beer and wine industry would step up and say, you know, you're right. We are part of the problem. This is our turn to step up to the door and say we'll accept an increase. And then perhaps they're good to not be bothered again for another 10 years. You know, they've stepped up and not having an increase in so many years doesn't seem quite right. We keep going to cigarette tax. And then, of course, this may be the time for all Oregonians to understand that they may be able-bodied today, but it isn't going to stop them from getting older. And it doesn't mean that they're not hit by an uninsured driver tomorrow and that they'll always have the resources they need. So if the system gets built up by increased funds from the taxpayers, it may someday pay off for them. So I'm not an economist. I'm a gerontologist. So
you're an advocate.
Sorry.
And by ballot measure, I assume you mean 88.
Correct.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jacqueline, you said something that I need your help with. You said that part of this process was terrorizing old people, and I had a call the other night that just about broke my heart. It was a 81-year-old woman on the phone crying and about OPI. And I asked her at the end of the conversation whether or not she was just a keen observer of the process or whether or not she had been asked to call me by somebody. And she said she'd been asked to call me. It was clear she didn't understand all the implications of the issue. At the end of the day, I don't think there's any one of us, Republican or Democrat, who wants to deprive an elderly person of care or independence or any of the other services. But help me understand how, if you're now faulting the legislature for terrorizing old people, how is using them to lobby not frightening them?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, my first thought about that is I assume it's not entirely different than educating parents about what happens when they lose services in the schools. And we try to create a seamless system for our people. And to be honest, if they don't understand the full implications of it, that's because by the time you come to us, it's not because you have the clarity that this committee has today. It's because you're older, you're frail, You're probably not feeling well, and we've done our best to make it a seamless system for you where you get help. I think that many of these people are terrorized because in the last year we've had to send letters out twice telling them that they are going to lose their services. We've had to do that because we want them to have as much time as possible to construct another support system if that's possible. So I say that I can't really fault people for asking you to call. I think we want them to explain to legislators the kind of things that they get as a person who is using OPI.
Well, I guess is all I'm asking is I'm it hurts me to talk to those people, but I'm happy to do it. I just would ask you, and you're doing your job, and so are your colleagues, in really zealous lobbying, to make sure that the people that you're asking to call are not so frightened that if there's a point where advocacy, I think, slips over into using some of the folks. And I'm looking at you and your colleagues in the front row who I know are zealous advocates for seniors. And every time I see Lee, and I presume he's in here somewhere, it makes me shiver that he's going to come and really be the kind of zealous advocate that seniors deserve. And I don't think they really appreciate the great job that he does. But I guess I'm making a plea to have somebody down the line exercise some caution in the use of the clients. This lady didn't understand any piece of what was happening to her, but she knew something bad was happening. And I think to the degree that you don't just frighten people, that might be a good thing. It's just one observation.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Jacqueline? I think at the same time, though, Representative Johnson, I mean, many of the seniors do know what's going on, not in an advocacy sense, and I mean, I think they are genuinely very concerned.
Sure, they are, and I don't dispute it, and it is effective lobbying. I mean, that phone call is seared in my mind.
How long is it going to take you to figure out that it was actually your mother that was calling?
About 10 minutes.
You've never had a 10-minute conversation with your mother in your life. Neither have I. I think both points are equally well taken. Thank you, Jacqueline. I have some very disturbing news for Steve Dole. However, it will make Nancy quite happy. Our crack legislative council has delivered to me history of the first act of our territorial government was in February of 1841. And it was a gathering of male settlers convened to select a supreme judge, in quotes, to decide who owned the Chehalem Valley after the death of a Mr. Ewing Young, who had passed on to the great beyond without a clear heir. So I guess, Steve, we had to have them damn judges to put them in the damn jail, you know? And that is according.
I didn't have a Supreme Court judge before. I thought we didn't have it until 1859.
The terminology, according to Mr. I.C. Terry in his History of Oregon, published in 1922, page 370, sir, the name of the government official selected was a Supreme Judge.
Obviously,
that's why.
Madam, sir, Mr. Chair, would that be analogous to a Supreme Chairman?
No, I don't. Do we have an update on the football game?
We're at 15 on the double pass with 5:10 left. Dr. Brown, President, State 15, 4, 4, 22.
I don't want to hear any of this Gator crap.
Anyone else on the sheet, John? Well, not seeing anyone else on the sheet. I assume everyone else is completely satisfied with their issues. They don't need additional funding. They have no concerns with what's going on. So we will adjourn the committee. No, that's...
Mr. Chair, you may have a hand.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify? I mean, we are here for you. Phyllis, come on up. And we need some Bob Castagna caliber ideas. That was a great idea, Bob, if you're still here. He is, yeah. Phyllis, enter and sign in, please.
Phyllis Ryan, Governor's Commission on Senior Services. I would be remiss not to say something. This is a very important time and a very disturbing time. And previous time, I have done some testimony before this committee, but there is an issue that hasn't been discussed, and I'd like to bring it up again. It's called delay of implementation of any new programs that the 2001-03 legislature implemented. Now, that's not been on the books, and I'd just like to tell you that that's an important piece, because I think that the cuts that I see in the governor's budget don't look to me or to the commission like they're 2% across the board. You know, when you do away with GA, you do away with RSVP that gets a very high match. I'd have to check it out, but I've heard that it's a 7-to-1 match. No.
I think that's
don't quote me on that, but okay. Then of course OPI, and the very fact that if the governor does start his cuts on Tuesday, notices are going to have to go out to the clients, OPI clients. Because that's slated, effective as of October the 2nd, it said in this document. They have to be given notice. We can't just move them out on the street. It's terrible. So increase beer and wine tax, and we want to add pop to that list. We think that's a very good choice, and we've been hearing that from people on the speaker's tour. People have been mentioning that. Okay. Thank you.
Hold on.
Okay.
You're talking about new programs. I didn't quite get your point there. Are you saying one of the ways to balance the budget is eliminate all new programs?
Eliminate the programs that were developed as a part of the 2001-03 budget.
That's regular session.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let me just make a comment on that. You know, at one point in time, OPI was a new program.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah, but at one point in time,
right.
OPI was a new program.
That's right.
You know, so was spousal pay. And the reason we did those programs, any new program at any given time, is in response to and the evolution of needs of the state.
Well,
so at some point in time, you know, these new programs may, I'm not saying
right.
that they all do, but I'm saying at some point in time, these programs probably provide, in response to changing needs of the state, provide a better utilization of taxpayer dollars than some older programs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, just because it's a new program doesn't mean that it doesn't provide a more cost-effective return to people who are paying the bill. Mm-hmm. Taxpayers.
So, Representative Westland, I'm not saying that they're not good programs. I'm just saying because of the budget of the loss of revenue of $482 million, I think we need to look at those.
Because they're not your program.
Oh, yes, there are some. And that to temporarily delay them until we're in a better financial position. I don't mean do away with them. I'm just saying that, and perhaps what we ought to do is to really look at some of the other things. But for right now, you know, we can go back and review the other programs, and if they don't show that they we're getting our money's worth, that we can do away with them, you know, in the hearings process with a budget. But for right now, we have a budget crunch. Let's delay these new programs so that we'll have additional revenue, so that we don't have to completely get rid of programs that have proved to be financially and effective.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's one of those.
Airline pop.
Yes.
Delay, and this is not what you said before. You said.
I'm sorry. Right.
New program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Delay.
It's good to see you. You know what's even better?
It's better to see you up here without that damn Lee Hazelwood next
to you. Oh, he'll be heartbroken.
Anyone else want to testify? Lee, are you going to do senior issues? Come on up. Indigent defense is halfway to the sky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Very quickly, my name is Ann Christian. I've been the Director of Indigent Defense Services Division for 14 years now, and I wanted to quickly testify both in my professional position, but then as a private citizen of the state of Washington, so I maybe bring a bit of a different perspective to this body. But quickly, with regard to Indigent Defense.
You're a citizen of the state of Washington?
I am.
You're one of those people that run across the state
and pay income tax and sales tax in my home state. That's correct.
Mm.
With regard to Indigent Defense, just very quickly, and I raise this, Mr. Chair, because you indicated that you presumed those sitting in the audience who had not testified were hunky-dory as far as their position, and I want to assure you and the committee that Indigent Defense quickly has taken reductions during the first 4 special sessions amounting to 13.6%. Put another perspective on that, the current funding for Indigent Defense is 1.2% more than the funding for 1999-01, the prior biennium. And I raise that in the context of other public safety cuts, not to say that other public safety entities should take higher cuts. That's not my position at all. In fact, I'm a strong advocate of working together as part of a system in public safety, and I would recommend that more of that type of work needs to occur between the public safety entities. And I only want to say as well that so many times people assume Indigent Defense is public defense representing criminals, or some of the most horrible crimes having been committed recently. And criminal cases, as far as Indigent Defense, is a little over 50% of what the workload is for all of those private attorneys, as opposed to state employees who provide, we have no state employees who provide Indigent Defense work. But a large portion of our workload, which is tied into the testimony you heard from Department of Human Services and so many other agencies, is civil commitment and juvenile matters. Dependency matters have been our fastest growing caseload over the past 5-6 years.
What was the fastest growing caseload?
Juvenile dependency cases. So the abuse and neglect cases where SDF has to come into a family and take children out when the court then immediately hears the case, those parents who are financially ineligible or eligible for court-appointed counsel would get counsel appointed. As you've well heard, many of these parents are in, I'll say, distress at the point in time when their children are taken away. We also have the obligation, the mandate by statute, to provide counsel to the children who have been removed from their families. And part of the reason, and it over the years has made a lot of sense to me is that the ultimate that may occur in one of these abuse and neglect cases is that the parental rights may be terminated. And the Supreme Court has held that there's a due process right that being a parent and being a child with a parent is so incredibly important. It's similar to going to jail as far as your responsibilities to that person to make sure there isn't a mistake. So I just want to make sure, because every time I turn around and I see anything written about indigent defense by others, it always refers to the criminal part of our case. But now to the private side, being a resident of the state of Washington now for 22 years, a few observations.
I have called Paul Werner and asked him to calculate the loss of revenue to the state of Oregon in the form of property tax. You're not contributing to the solution, so.
Come in.
But I drive those roads every day. Mr. Chair, in the state of Washington, there is no income tax. There is a sales tax, and it's almost 10%. And that sales tax, I think of Oregon in those instances when I buy a new car, and I pay a sales tax, and it's hefty. And Washington State also has had, until recently, a relatively much higher annual vehicle tax. From my memory, I'm thinking in the neighborhood of $500 and $600 per year is what I would write the check for, and it's based on the value of the vehicle, and I don't own a very expensive vehicle. And I believe that some...
Do you pay extra for those flowers on your Volkswagen?
I have no Volkswagen. Actually, I do. I have to be honest. I have one that's in storage that I can't give up. But the other personal part of it is I am a smoker, and Washington State has raised the cigarette tax amount, and I am personally not opposed to increase taxes on beer, wine, cigarettes. And every day, I see the impact of the uncertainty across the board. I mean, especially within the judicial department with what occurred within the courts and also, Mr. Chair, within indigent defense providers, our contractors, where we're currently at 1.2% additional funding over the prior biennium. And I have to say that as a smoker and someone who occasionally has a beer, I would welcome the opportunity to spend more money on those taxes and to see what I've seen occur over the past 14 years. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Excuse me, Ann. Lee Hazelwood is acting up in the back. He wants to know the score of the game.
That's just for 107 left.
Yeah.
Okay.
Touchdown
or a field goal?
Humble apology for that interruption.
No,
seven. Eight or six or seven.
Now, here's an interesting comment. That gentleman that you see walking around in the nice, he's left now, nice jacket, I mean, it's all the, you know, suede, dark, bushy hair.
Yes.
He's a reporter from the Seattle Times. And he's down, his paper sent him down, and wants, where's Groner? Here's a Groner comment. They sent him down to cover Oregon's budget problems because... Just see the similarity.
Yeah.
Washington has round numbers, comparable period of time, a $22 billion general fund budget, and they have a $1.3 billion shortfall. We have, obviously, round numbers, $12 billion general fund and a 1.7 plus shortfall. They have a sales tax. And they don't have an income tax. We have an income tax, and we don't have a sales tax. I don't know what I'm saying when I say that.
I don't know why that's
interesting. You know, yeah, and we have Ward Gordon is living in Washington. So I don't know if you can draw any correlation to that. Anyway, talk with that guy. He's a very engaging gentleman. He's a great guy.
Anyone else want to testify? Nancy?
Jeff Smith said 2-point conversion,
24,107.
Oh, my God.
Lee. Make it quick, buddy, because I got to see the end of this game.
My name is Lee Hazelwood, senior advocate for over 20 years, most of you, but I want to go on the record as saying that I did not call Representative Johnson's mother to tell her to call her, but I understand Mrs. Johnson has a wonderful daughter who works sometimes, labors hard for the Oregon State Legislature. I am concerned about the notification of these people losing service the 1st of October. I want to emphasize again what I've said before, that people taking care of these clients are normally located in your area and my area, getting paid wages. Some of them pay a little bit of income tax on those wages. I want to emphasize that again. Last session, due to hard work by some of you setting up there, we were able to get OPI funded to the 1999 level. And I've said this time and time again, if every other budget was funded the 1999 level, we wouldn't be able to take care of some of the people, but we might not be in a fix we're in today. The truth about Oregon Project Independence. Oregon Project Independence is a program in-home services designed for people who do not qualify for Medicaid or low income and need services to prevent premature institutionalization. Clients who receive OPI services are frail as those qualifying for Medicaid. Oregon Project Independence is the crowning jewel of Oregon's innovative community-based care system. And this has been asked before, but the program operates on a sliding fee scale so participants contribute to their own care. Statewide in Oregon, more than 50% of the Oregon OPI clients are at least 80 years old. This is the fastest growing segment of our society. More than 75% are living on Social Security, and 40% are at or below the poverty level. The typical client is female, sorry about that gentlemen, 75%, and live alone, 69% of them. The Oregon Project Independence Program helps approximately 4,000 vulnerable seniors every year. Many of these people would need more expensive care in a nursing home or some other setting if the program were cut. Still others in the possibility of cuts would simply be neglected and do without the most basic care. And so I guess the question I wanted to ask, which was asked maybe 2,000 years ago, a little bit more than that, who is my neighbor? And the question was, take care of your neighbor. And the person being asked that said, who is my neighbor? So I would say this, my neighbor and your neighbor is the neighbor in your local community. Thank you. Willing to answer any questions.
Thank you, Lee. Any questions for Mr. Hazelwood?
Thank you.
And I am interested in the score, Mr. Sherman, because I have a son that graduated from Oregon and 3 granddaughters that graduated from Oregon State, so
big problem.
Not a problem.
Come on up, Chuck. I'm very interested in your riveting testimony.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Sherman.
This will just take a minute.
That's okay.
Enter and sign in, please. Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. You have heard extensively from my colleague, Ozzie Rose, on the impact of cuts, and I'd really like to confine my remarks to just the portion of your discussion, because we don't, again, I, as Lori Wimmer Whalen mentioned, we don't have a bill in front of us, but I'd like to confine my comments to November.
This is
or to placing any issues on the ballot as opposed to enacting them. Mr. Chairman, a couple of thoughts. Looking at the November ballot, we're very concerned that any tax issue placed on the ballot in November, in particular, is going to be surrounded with a number of other local tax measures throughout the state, as well as the single-payer plan, which has a substantial tax component associated with it, and we think will result in a very clouded discussion of the taxes associated with the issues at hand that you might place in front of them. And we would like, if we're going to end up on the ballot, at least be on the ballot alone or without a lot of confusing information on the ballot. Mr. Chairman, we are on the ballot. It's not like K-12 doesn't seem to get a chance out there. We're on the ballot, as you know, September 17th for $150 million. Of this year's funding. To put a further amount on the ballot seems to be creating just one more hurdle for K-12. I guess I want to add one other element to this, and if I say this wrong, I hope I'll be corrected, but if you go to the ballot with an issue associated with taxation, you're going to have to go through now a disappropriation process in order to get rid of the funds to take out, to go out and ask for those monies. Whereas if you would enact the tax measure up or down at this point, it really becomes the voters' responsibility to disappropriate the funds for K-12 or whatever programs you put out there. We tend to assume you're going to put K-12 out there. We would like to not have that lack of connectivity. They seem to be able, voters seem to be able, and you all know voters better than we do, but they seem to be able to vote against taxes and not take responsibility for the impact of that vote against taxes, and that might be what you're setting up if you don't make this an up or down vote and force them to take the responsibility for cutting the programs that result from a referral by whoever would try to refer any tax measure you would pass. And at some point, we're hoping, at some point there will come a time when voters in Oregon are going to absolutely have to take the kind of direct responsibility that could be placed on them this session for cutting the kinds of programs that are at stake, whether it's $400 million, $300 million, $350, $250 million of K-12, or senior services, as we just heard, or any other program, and it would seem that you may be frustrating that if you do the disappropriation and hand them the tax.
Chuck, I almost see it just the opposite. If we don't do the disappropriation, then if this matter is referred, there isn't any apparent. It's not apparent to the voters what's going to be lost. It's just going to be an amorphous reduction in revenue that the state will just have to absorb. Don't you actually have better connectivity between the voters and the impact of the measure if you have a disappropriation that will take effect if the measure is defeated? Because then you've got tax cuts, tax cuts. If we don't do the disappropriation, there aren't any cuts that would be apparent if anybody's guessed what those cuts would be, and everyone could assume that it's going to be somebody else's program and not theirs, or it's going to be one of those non-essential programs that we have so many of that, you know, that we could get rid of without anybody seeing. I think the connectivity is better if you do a disappropriation.
I think you can argue that point, and I think justifiably argue it that way. I guess the experience we've had is ballot measure 13 went out. Clearly, it was going to result in a direct impact to K-12 and loss. Yet the public says, in any poll you look at, K-12 is at the very top of their list in terms of support. You can go back, I think, in time, ballot measure five. I mean, what was going to be the impact of ballot measure five? It was going to. I think one argument we've heard was it was going to result in equity in school finance. Well, in fact, the result has been equity in school finance just a lot lower than it would have been without ballot measure 5. I don't know that it perhaps is the campaign, it is perhaps other things that go on. We just haven't been able to develop that connection with them. And I think that if you do the we continue to believe, I think, that if you do the disappropriation and put the measure out, they continue to believe they're voting on taxes. They're not voting on K-12 or on whatever other program there is. Now, you certainly could design a program, design a campaign that links them, but it has sure been difficult to do so far.
Yeah,
that's fair. Fair comment,
fair change. Anything else, sir?
No, thank you.
Representative Bates. Mr. Chair, just to follow up on what Representative Shirley is saying, how would you feel about a tax measure that was directed solely to K-12? We're looking at a $350 million tax measure that said this money is going directly to K-12. This is not passed.
No, we would prefer you enact that measure. We've got a history, I guess, with our organization. We have supported anything the legislature has done that's provided some sort of funding and certainty for K-12 during this year, with the understanding that in the next biennium we're going to deal with long-term funding issues. We would like to have some certainty coming out of the fifth special session. And putting us on the ballot doesn't give us that certainty.
Let me clarify that question. I didn't make it clear. I would have to spread a vote, okay? The time specific, if it was challenged by the public that they went out, that it would be a vote based on you want to fund K-12 or not. Let's get that out to the public and let them make a decision. So if we want, and not a confused one. I would have a straight up vote if we vote the money to K-12 now, okay? And then it's challenged and goes out.
Where's
your certainty?
The certainty is certainly missing there, isn't it? And that's something we're very interested in.
The point that Representative Sherman, I think, is trying to make, and made very well.
Yeah.
And I guess one other thing, Chuck, you've been around this business longer than I have, but generally speaking, a tax measure, do you want a tax measure out in a high turnout election or a low turnout election?
I think you tend to want them out in lower turnout elections if you get the opportunity. Yeah, we're more target. I would be more interested in that. I think if I was thinking about how to put the campaign together with about 2 seconds to think about it, I'd want to aim at a more controlled turnout.
At a lower turnout.
At least in that way, I guess it would be lower.
That goes. It's counterintuitive.
I could well be wrong. I'm just, you're asking me something just off. I think the tradition in school funding has been the ninth Tuesday in May on a cold and dark, you know, going back to those old levy elections. I mean, I think that's been the tradition, but I don't see any reason why you would take this out into a real high turnout election, particularly when in a crowded ballot.
One of the things when I talk to my constituents that they're very interested in is knowing whether or not the money that goes into K-12 at this point is being efficiently spent, or whether there's room for improvement in the way that we actually use the money that's allocated right now. How do you see, first of all, I guess, do you see that as an important aspect of getting people to a place where they're willing to take a reasoned look at raising the amount of money that goes into the system? And secondly, if you do, how do you see us getting to that place where we can communicate that to the people?
Well, I think efficiency is always the aim of any government entity. I mean, I think we're trying to always convince those we serve that we're providing the best service for the least possible price. I think we're engaged in a longer-term process that's going to take us through a transition in public school funding, K-12 funding, and that has been one of the center discussion elements, is taking a look at K-12 funding throughout the state. Under the current configuration, we have 198 separate school districts, 198 budget committees with 198 budget hearing opportunities for the public in any of those communities to come in and talk about the way the funds are being spent in their community. And I think that at this point, that's been the best system we've contrived. We're going to be spending over the next year or two, I think, a great deal of time looking at the efficiency of the K-12 system and patterns of spending, and we're in the process with our colleagues at OEA and OSDA in developing information for you in your next regular session to assist in that, as well as to communicate that to the public.
As a follow-up, the discussions, again, that I've had with folks down in my district is that there's a high level of concern that they're telling me that about half the money that we push into the front end of the system actually makes it down to the school districts to be divvied up. And the question they're asking is, what happens to the half that they don't get? Is OSDA doing anything to address that issue?
I'm with COSA, but I think OSDA, COSA, no problem. And OEA.
You and Marshall look a lot.
We do look a lot. Like
I have some.
Yeah, I have the younger and the shorter one. But we are, we're certainly taking a look at all of that kind of information. I think Representative Shetterly is, are you chairing or co-chairing the task force on this? One of the agreements we've had in going into the task force discussion on long-term school funding has been to take a look at all of these numbers. And if it is 50% in and only 50% reaching the classroom, what's going on? Is it, in fact, are those the real numbers? I mean, these are all items, I think, that are on the table. There is nothing we are not talking about right now. And I think as you and your constituents have those concerns, they would hopefully become part of the mix and part of the testimony and discussion as this resolves itself over the next year.
So given the confusion or the lack of concrete information that we can all agree on about where the money goes right now and the absence of a discussion about whether the way that we use it is the most efficient way to use it, what's your feeling on going into essentially a vote on whether to fund K-12 at a higher level or not at this point? And what I'm particularly interested in is, are we going to mess up the long-term discussion? Are people going to think that the problem has been solved?
I think that's a very good question, Representative. I think that's one of the challenges of having an election, is to have the voters vote, have them believe they resolved the question. We were very concerned about it even with ballot measure 19, that they would vote for a rainy day fund and somehow think they resolved the long-term issue. There is a great deal of confusion about these ballot measures and their effect on school funding statewide and a future resolution of finding a basic K-12 funding. I share your concerns.
Any other questions for Chuck Marshall Bennett?
It's got to worry.
That does worry.
Chris?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I had no intention of testifying before you today, except for the frightening statement made by the chair just prior to my changing that decision. I don't want you to think we're happy. and that's
well,
our main message.
Well, I'm the committee, so I don't think, you know, this is on the record, right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, members of my organization and our members do not envy your task here. We understand how difficult this is, how difficult it's been all year. As you try to deal with a situation we never, in our wildest dreams, our wildest nightmares, contemplated, five special sessions dealing with a continuing hole that just seems to get bigger and bigger. While we appreciate the problems that you have in dealing with this, we also hope that you appreciate what's happening in our schools, on the ground, with our kids right now, and what will happen next year, not to mention the year after that. We are so focused sometimes in this building on the difficulties that we have in this building that we forget that this is a very long-term, education is a long-term issue. It's not what the problem is today, it's what's been happening for decades in Oregon's education system, and what seems to continue to happen, and that is that we get bogged down in details, and we forget that our kids are depending on the education right now. I have an eighth grader who can't wait. I had a discussion with a friend of mine who is a lobbyist for another organization about when we should fix the K-12 funding problem. He thinks it needs to be fixed before his daughter starts school in 4 years. I think my eighth grader needs it fixed today. Neither of us are going to get what we want at the moment. I am here to suggest to you that you, in our opinion, we would like you to enact legislation to fill the hole now between for this biennium and for the projected hole in the next biennium, to give you time to find a solution to long-term funding in the next session. We don't think that a $1.5 billion deficit next session that has been unfilled at this point will allow you to really focus that discussion in spite of your best efforts. It is very difficult, as you know, having gone through this last year, to talk about tax proposals and tax reform proposals, which is what we all have to talk about. We're in this situation, as the chair said, because Oregon is dependent on the income tax, and in a recession, the income tax can't fill the gap. We have to talk about a different way to fund schools, or perhaps an additional way to fund schools. In any case, we have to do it with our plates cleared of other crises, and I think a $1.5 billion deficit next time is going to cloud that discussion significantly. We hope that you will enact, because, as someone earlier said, it's very difficult to convince the voters that what they're voting on today isn't the solution, regardless of what that issue is. They thought they voted on it in May. They think they're voting on it this month. They may think they're voting on it in November. And next year, we hope that you come up with a long-term solution that they will be able to vote on. So our position is enact.
Any questions? Representative Devlin.
Somewhere back in my archives at home, I have a piece of political literature. I have a lot of pieces. But one of these is from a House candidate back in the early 70s and late 60s, I think early 70s. And that person is not a lobbyist here in...
One of the...
but it talks about the need to have adequate and stable school funding. I think those are the exact terminology that it uses.
That's right.
I think that's probably a goal we need to get to. But how do we define it? That's been my tougher question. Even Representative Hayden, who was here the other day, was asking that very question in a roundabout way. How do we really define what is adequate and stable? I don't think we can probably ever say that any service that is provided to the public, whether it's education, human services, or public safety, is never going to go for a need being unmet. You know, you can't say forever that you're going to have a solution and you're never going to have to have a problem with this again, and the Dr. Bates here, healthcare is going to be resolved. No American is ever going to have to worry about the cost of healthcare again. What is adequate and stable? How would you define it? I've got to answer a few more questionnaires here in the next couple of weeks, so I'm looking for
stable is easy. Adequate is a hard one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, that is a big question. I would suspect that you might find differences between Mr. Bennett and I and what adequate is.
And Mr. Chair, follow up. I know the
quality interrupts a witness.
I know, Mr.
She wasn't answering.
I know the quality education model backwards and forwards, but I don't think that's entirely the answer either.
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, my way of thinking, adequate funding for education is funding adequate to provide for the educational needs of a child entering kindergarten, entering preschool, all the way through higher education at a level that would allow that child as an adult to compete in the real world, in the real market, that will allow our communities to thrive, that will bring economic development opportunities to our communities because we have an educated, stable workforce. An adequate education is one that will allow my son to continue his band because he loves it and allow him to have algebra in the eighth grade. An adequate education is one where all children have an opportunity. All children. Not just those who have the parents who have the wherewithal to supplement the education that they're getting in school. I think that our civilization is dependent on that opportunity for all children.
Now, Trish, that articulate statement in 50 cents will get you a cup of coffee, isn't it?
Mr. Chair, I was just answering the question.
I know what you're saying.
$5.76.
We've quantified this, and we're not going to do it here today.
Mr. Chair, if I may, we have mechanisms put in place because this is not the first legislature to wonder what the word adequate means. So legislators prior have put a mechanism called the Quality Education Commission in place specifically to guide them in that question, to tell them what's needed to provide the education that our children need. Let's use the systems that in your wisdom you've put in place to make those decisions and then rely on that and then go back home and ask your constituents what their children need.
Representative Sherry.
Thank you. Something more immediate, Tricia and Chuck and Gearsville there, let me ask you. I was one who in 1999 voted for what seemed like a pretty common sense, basic, concrete on the road measure to enact an act, not to refer, but to enact a 5 cent gas tax increase. I got referred like that. Given that I don't think the environment has particularly changed on tax measures external to this building, do you want to put the odds on a popular referendum of a straight up vote in this building?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, I really think it's fair to say that a referral of this K-12 funding measure is substantially different than a gas tax. I really think the politics of it are different. I think the support groups in place for K-12 are different. I think more aggressive. I think referral of that measure is going to be a challenge.
You mean referendum?
I think it's going to be a real challenge to get that measure on the ballot. I don't think this is a slam dunk. I'd give it at least even odds it stays off the ballot. And we'd like to at least have a shot at it. We'd like to see you enact it, and we'll take up the ballot. Don't just hand us the fight. Let us at least begin the fight on our terms.
Mr. Chair, the fight, were you going to put bodyguards in front of the
whatever it takes.
The hordes that are breaking down the barriers to get to the people that are holding the petitions? That's different than the campaign. That's it. You can't actively interfere with someone wanting to sign a petition.
But we can actively begin a voter education project and begin the kind of activities that we think would that could be associated with, and I'm not going to say this is a done deal, but we would certainly rather approach it from that perspective enacted than we would starting with you referring it to the November ballot.
Mr. Chair, if I may, Representative Shetterly, I'm not sure where this fits in my job description, but prior to my job, I had and continue to have a great reverence for this body and this process. And I see, in my opinion, I have seen it erode in the minds of the public year after year after year as your power is usurped by chief petitioners and their ideas and your ability to govern the state is hampered by those restrictions. I believe that for the sake of this body, it is important that you stand and face the voters with us for what you believe and do that through enactment.
Brave words. Bravely spoken.
The
I think the point where I take issue, Trish, is on the reference to the $1.5 billion shortfall. That's a nice number. It's going around. The governor cited it. It's become gospel. I don't buy that number. I mean, fortunately, I believe it is much lower. But we would both agree it is a significant shortfall next session. Where I think I really take exception is in the overall approach trying to get to, you know, fundamental tax reform, which we both agree on, is if you take $1 billion and put it into this body next session, you've taken all the pressure out of the balloon, and we fiddle and diddle around, and the political pressures, you know, force us into inactivity again. I think you need to quit. I mean, that's my opinion. Go ahead, respond.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, we are at the brink right this minute, and I haven't seen a great deal of activity in this building since I came back from vacation on Friday.
And I know you're sitting on your porch. You didn't go anyplace with
me. No, sir. That is not true. I was out there in the world, and I've come to the conclusion that they're not paying attention. But nevertheless, at OSCA, as you know, we too are concerned about the legislature's willingness next session to address tax reform and long-term solutions to school funding. That's why we have developed the school funding pledge and asked candidates and legislators to sign it, many, many, many of whom have signed it very willingly. And we believe that the point of that pledge is to cause people to put their signature where their mouth is and their commitment where their mouth is, to not leave this building next session without a solution to this problem, so that we don't have to continue to go through this time after time after time. We think that the pledge will assist the leadership of this body and the citizens of Oregon to come to the table and find a solution to this problem. We are doing everything we can to help ease the burden of legislators and candidates to reach that hard place where they say the word taxes, where they say the word tax reform, and come up with a plan for our kids and our schools.
And I still say, if you put $1 billion into this body next session, it would be the greatest mistake, one of the greatest misfortunes to befall Oregon. Because you'll put that money in here, the economy will start to barely recover, hopefully. By the way, November doesn't look very good either in terms of the forecast.
Mm-hmm.
So you put that $1 billion in here, the economy will start to recover, and we'll muddle along for another 10 years.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand then what your point is. Your point then that we continue kind of over the bridge, or what do we do? What would we do in your scenario? I'm just not sure I understand.
My scenario is, I mean, Chris made the comment that we pass surcharges either in the building, outside the building, whatever. We create enough revenue to get us through next biennium.
Yeah.
Whatever the methodology is.
You know, the most optimistic number I've seen was beginning the session short about, I think the one I saw today was $730 million. I mean, my impression was we would begin the next session short at least that amount. We just wouldn't begin it short $1.5 billion under the scenario you all seem to be discussing as we're beginning to get a picture of it. But I didn't have the impression there would be a substantial amount of additional funds in place under any scenario, being certainly nothing I'm sitting here advocating results in that I'm aware of, an extra $1 billion in the kitty.
Well, don't forget, we began last session $700 million
right
underwater.
Right, you did a beautiful job, Mr. Chairman.
It's
nice meeting you again here. About
it. Can we play that back again? I didn't quite hear that.
See, I think this conversation that Trish and I are having is one of the real issues. I mean, she's heartfelt, honest, and sincere. I'm heartfelt, honest, and sincere. I mean, this is a critical juncture that we're at, I mean, in this fifth special session.
Chair, along those lines, how you arrive at the next session is important, too. If you arrive there with borrowed money, to patch this over again, I think you do no service to the people of Oregon. If you arrive there with raised income taxes, you might focus the question a little more. Also, if you arrive there with $1 billion in your pocket, you get patched over again. You're right. Somewhere in between there is where you have to arrive.
Yeah,
number of problems remaining that is still the burning question. Not so much there that you can't come to a resolution for it. And not with borrowed money.
Mr. Chair? If I can just say one more thing about this, I will say that while I do appreciate how difficult these issues are for elected officials to deal with because of their concerns about how they're going to be viewed at home, I know that you know that as everyone here this afternoon has described to you in very heart-wrenching detail, we're not talking about $1 billion. We're talking about whether or not my eighth grader gets algebra, whether or not seniors on OPI have a home. Those are the kinds of things we're talking about. And we have to put faces on these numbers and realize that this isn't about whether or not we're doing what our members think is a good idea or you're doing what your constituents are thinking is a good idea. We all know what the real issues are on the ground in Oregon, and we just have to face them. We just have to. And we have to make sure that people are elected who are willing to face those issues. I wish we were all sitting around in an economy with a gob of money and lots of places we could spend it, so we're just talking about whether or not to spend it on arts or spend it on the beach. But we're not.
Yeah, but see, that's where we disagree. Those faces, those seniors, those eighth graders, those third graders, those hungry, putting those people in mind, if I could push the button right now and make it so, I would build a rickety bridge in the next session, making sure we take care of their needs as adequately as we possibly can this biennium and get us into next session with a big problem. That's the only way you're going to solve Oregon's tax structure. Not putting $1 billion in there to Band-Aid and bubblegum the thing over again. What I hear you saying is, gee, let's put enough money in the next biennium so if something doesn't happen, and I know you're out there with a pledge, then it'll be okay. I can almost guarantee you nothing will happen. If we put $1 billion in the next biennium, we won't get it done. What I can't guarantee you is if we're, pick a number, $1 billion short, we will get it. I can't guarantee you we will get it done. But I know there are enough of us, both sides of the aisle, both sides of the building, that are willing to work for it, that we've got a good shot. And we're saying kind of the same thing, different, the opposite side of the same coin.
And, Mr. Chair, that's my final point, is that in spite of all of the horrendous pain and difficulty this process is creating for all of us, I do know that, and as you do, I hope, know that we are all on the same side here, the side of Oregonians and the families that we all represent. So whether we get bogged in the details, or it's up to us.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Well, I know it's late, and I want to go home in front of as bad as anything.
And I want to go on record letting everyone know that I have invited Representative Morgan to go out to Silverton to the tractor pull and the monster truck bash tonight. So, I mean, we have an important social opportunity.
Well, sublimity.
Sorry. Just so that silence might not be interpreted as acquiescence, I do want to respond again to something else, Tricia, that you said, and that is that the concern of members being how they're going to be viewed back home. I don't care about that. That doesn't. In fact, there are days when I wish that I could be viewed back home so that voters would vote me out and I could go back to work and let somebody else deal with this. Truly, truly.
I think the real problem in this building is that you have 90 legislators who reflect the very same kind of conflicts and inconsistencies and diversity of opinions on taxes and spending and programs and services that are reflected in the populace that brings these people here. I just don't see this as being a problem of something quite as base as how we look to our constituents back home. I don't care. I'm doing the best job I can, and as long as I can say that, I sleep fine at night, and the rest of it can take care of itself. But that doesn't make it any easier, because I've got people who believe just the opposite that I do, and who are just as heartfelt in their faith and belief that they're representing their constituents in the way their constituents have elected to be represented. So that's the issue. We got 90. I told this to one of the other school boards. How I wish that I could be a community member on that board, and four or five of us sit around and write an editorial that tells all these stupid legislators what they ought to do and how easy it ought to be to get there. I said, well, you know, but what you need to do is you need to expand the membership of the editorial board to 90. And then give your managing editor the final say on every editorial you write once you come to a consensus. You know, and make sure he's kind of disengaged. But, so I think what the problem here is not legislators wanting to be perceived a particular way at home, but really reflecting the very kinds of conflicts and inconsistencies and challenges that you have statewide. We represent the people, for better or for worse.
I think I know those profound words.
Great place to go. Yes.
Thank you very much.
We will adjourn the committee.